This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie. I'm the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And with me to manage your life is none other than the Carrie Kasem.
Hello, Alan.
Do you go by that on your Twitter feed?
The Carrie Kasem? No, actually, I was lucky enough to just be able to have my name. You know, a lot of real Carrie Kasem, because people have, you know, the same names as other people. I guess mine's rare, so I have it on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I have my real name instead of the real Carrie Kasem or Carrie Kasem Real or, you know, official Carrie Kasem. Most people have to add that.
I was at a wedding this past weekend, and I was talking to Scott Baio. Remember Scott Baio?
Chachi, of course I do.
Chachi, Charles in Charge.
Charles in Charge.
And he's the Scott Baio. There is one real Scott Baio, but the real Scott Baio isn't the real Scott Baio. It's the
See,
Scott Baio.
That's frustrating.
And it's funny because I happened to look it up, and I was in one of his tweets. He took a picture of he and his daughter dancing at the wedding, and I happened to be behind
in
him.
The back?
Yeah, in the background, just dancing away with my daughter, Harper. So we were tweeted with the Scott Baio, not the real one, but just the Scott Baio. But he happens to be the real one, and I spoke with his wife as well.
I was going to say, you had a long conversation with her. Isn't she going to come on?
I think they both will come
that
on.
Would be
they
nice.
Wanted to come on the show. They want to talk about a foundation. Unfortunately, they lost a twin. Bailey's their daughter, during the process of pregnancy, they lost one of the twins. And so they have a foundation. They want to talk about that. They have a big event in September, a golf tournament, and they will be promoting that. So we'll look for them in a future show. Later on in our show today, we have someone on the show who is on a really popular show. I know you watch it because you're really into real estate. And it's, you know.
Yeah, I love when you do this to me. I mean, you've done this so many times. You know how many times I've had to, like, Wayman bleep that? But, you know, we don't catch it in time. I don't watch reality.
So later on the show, Tracy Tudor is going to join us. And she is one of the star real estate agents on Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles. And we're going to talk to her about the real estate business and maybe about her divorce. She's very public divorce.
I mean, I've seen the show. Like, how many years ago? I was actually on it looking at a house one time because
really?
My friend was selling his house. So he's like, hey, come by. So yeah, I went by and they were filming the show.
And they have celebrity clients. A lot of them you see on the show. And of course, people follow it. They love watching the show because the characters on the show, the actors who aren't really actors, they're actually real estate agents, are really interesting. And we're going to ask Tracy about her cast of characters and about a new project that she has going on in Dubai. She was just awarded the Atlantis in Dubai to sell a lot of the homes, condos there. She's going to be the American ambassador to Dubai. Well, actually, the Atlantis.
Wow, that's a lot of money out there. That's
I think she deals with a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, it's $1 million listing. They all do, don't they?
I'd say multi-million dollar
listing. Yeah, probably.
Interestingly enough, Tracy grew up with my wife in Hidden Hills. I don't think they knew each other, but they went to the same school. And
it's beautiful out there. I always wanted to live out there because of the horse trails.
Yeah.
There's horse trails in front of everybody's houses.
Yeah, and my wife was, and you know that Nancy rides horses. And Tracy, I know she's part of the divorce was that she had to pay for the equestrian lessons for her daughters, Juliet and Scarlett.
Yeah, so. It's a big horse town out there.
But they don't live there anymore. She's selling her house. I believe it's in Bel Air for $24 million. So.
Oh,
Yeah, it's on the market if you're looking.
Yeah, that's really not in my budget. Yeah.
I know the real estate agent.
Well, good. Maybe she can give me a better deal.
She's the owner, too. I think it was valued at $18 million, but somehow it's on the market for $24 million. Okay. So that's Tracy Tudor later. But, you know, now we have, this is a great story. I love this story. So a few weeks back, we had Howard Wasserman on our show. He's a professor who wrote a book called The Infield Fly Rule is in Effect. And he's very interesting. We had a great show. He talked about that. And he talked about the infield fly rule and he related it to law and other things and how it was still an important part of the game. We received a letter, an email actually, from a guy who is listening. Brilliant, brilliant email. And I look and I say, if this is the judge, Andrew Guilford. And I'm thinking, wow, he has something to say about this, about Howard Wasserman, because he actually wrote a rebuttal to Howard Wasserman's book and had published an article some time ago about the infield fly rule. And as it happens, he is the authority on baseball and the law, amongst other things. He's an authority about so many things and why Maury Wills should be in the Hall of Fame, why he hates the designated hitter rule, so many things. And he's an accomplished judge who was appointed by George W. Bush in 2006. And he's in the United States District Court for the Central District of California Southern Division in Orange County. And I want to welcome Andrew Guilford to our show. Welcome to Gurfey's Law, Judge.
Thanks so much, Alan, and hello to you, Carrie.
Hi.
You know, it's so great to have you on. You are so accomplished. In fact, I read an article about you, and they called you Judge Superman because of so many things that you've done. But I know you have a keen interest in baseball, and that is something that's near and dear to my heart. Tell us how your interest in baseball and the law developed over the years.
Well, I do have a great interest in baseball. I think people's interests start to develop when they're around 12 years old. And when I was around 12 years old, the Dodgers were winning the World Series. So I became a Dodger fan, yeah. A Maury Wills fan. I just had to turn the radio down right now to talk to you because the Dodger game is on. And then I moved on to become a lawyer. And lawyers look at rules and lawyers look at law. And lawyers have a certain thing in their brain that often makes them fans of baseball. And I joined that group as a lawyer who likes baseball. And there are a lot of relationships going back to that article in 1975 about right. The infield fly rule. And that's kind of stayed with me.
And that was William Stevens of the University of Pennsylvania Law Review. And unfortunately, William Stevens passed away, I think, a couple of years ago.
At age 60, a young man.
At age 60. And you knew about this article. It was so intriguing. If they had the internet, it would have gone viral. People are saying, why is he writing about the infield fly rule? Was he a law student at the time when he wrote that?
He was a law student at the time. His article has been cited as one of the most popular student pieces or the most popular student pieces in the history of law reviews. And I think it's partly because it was about baseball, but partly because he poked fun at the pomposity of lawyers and their law reviews.
Yeah.
And there I was in 1975, graduating from law school, aware of this pomposity. And we were all so relieved to see this article, which poked fun at ourselves. By example, the first word of the article was the, and he dropped a footnote on the word the.
I love that.
And he continued with these tongue-in-cheek, witty footnotes that poked fun while still making an important point on baseball. And so, exactly 40 years later, I was honored to write a law review article trying to mimic his humor, probably failing at that.
No, I read it. You were very funny. Very yeah. funny.
Now, let me ask you guys, lawyers, because I am not one. A friend of mine was editor-in-chief of her law review magazine. That was a big honor for her at the time. When you write a law review article, are you back like at UCLA? Do you write it for your alma mater? How does that work?
Well, I'm always doing everything for my alma mater, but okay. It's mainly just to have a little fun and make judges and the law accessible, and occasionally to explore issues of scholarship and maybe write about the way we think the world should be rather than the way it is. But okay. A lot of different reasons. It's fun to write.
You know, I got to get to this as a fellow seamhead, and I know you like that term, seamhead.
Indeed. And your listeners might not know what it means,
yes,
but they probably can figure it out. It comes from puckhead for hockey fans.
So
we've developed our alternative for baseball fans.
Yeah, the baseball, the seams.
There
okay.
you go. So as a seamhead, you took seriously the article back then by Stevens and then Wasserman's book, and you have a rebuttal. You were a very accomplished trial attorney for 30 years, business trial attorney. So you are not unfamiliar with rebuttals to legal arguments. And here it is. I'm going to give you, Judge Guilford, a minute or two to make your rebuttal to the infield fly rule and the support of it still being in effect in 2019.
Wait, a minute or two? That's what I do to lawyers. Now you're doing this to this show. No, in a minute or two. First, for those who don't know, the infield fly rule is a rule that says if there's two people on base, it's not fair to drop the ball and throw out the two men, exchanging the one out for the two outs, and the infield fly rule doesn't allow that. I think we should allow it because I think it would be incredibly exciting to watch the base runners faint and make jukes and watch the infielder watch the base runner and decide whether they drop the ball and seek a double play or whether the base runners are already advancing and therefore the ball should be caught. And I posit a hypothetical, bases loaded, World Series, yeah, bottom of the ninth, pop up. What would happen? I think there would be players who wouldn't be smart enough to figure out what would happen. I think there would be brilliant players, as there are today when we see them drop balls and make certain plays. And I think that would be absolutely fascinating. I think the infield fly rule came from a time in the 1890s when people thought it was ungentlemanly,
yeah,
mm-hmm, drop a ball.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is clearly exciting, audacious, filled with risk and reward, and more reflective of today's society, which probably isn't kinder and gentler than it was in 1890.
You know, Andy, I don't disagree with you. And I, even though, you know, Howard was on the show talking about support for it, I think you make a really good argument. How do you compare the law when you talk about these rules? Because I agree, artificial rules, and we can talk about the DH rule as well in baseball, but there's so many things, and you see them all the time in the law as well, that kind of make things artificial versus letting the guys play the game.
Well, there you go. And that was the thrust of the 1975 article, that the infield fly rule developed like the common law develops to respond to a challenge. My response is it was a bad response. We should have an immediate legislative correction to it. And in that, we do have some parallels with the law. When the law is expanding in the wrong area, should we jump back in and bring it to the right area, maybe the area that more reflects our audacious society? And I think we should bring it into that area. And so that's kind of an intersection of the law and baseball, and kind of an interesting way, started in 1975 by Stevens and imitated by me.
Now, I know that you don't like the designated hitter rule, and I want to find out about that. I know we have to take a break in just a second. Should we leave this hanging so we find out, Alan, or can he answer that now?
I think we're going to use that as a cliffhanger. We're in the bottom of the ninth, and the score is tied, and Judge Andrew Guilford is going to come up to bat after the break. And just to, I read about Judge Guilford. They said, you're an inspiration to all of the A-type personalities out there. Keep running. He's got so much going on, and we're going to find out if he can knock it out of the park after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, exposure, cancers, and death. RGW lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com. Welcome back to Gervey's Law. Still thinking about what can go wrong? Instead, let's get excited about what can go right on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Getting to put me in coach.
Here we
He's
go.
He's sitting on the
Here
bench.
We go. Turn it up.
Oh, put me in coach. I'm ready to play.
All right.
Woo!
Yeah.
There we go.
This is exciting. You know, we're talking to Judge Andrew Guilford, who is with the United States District Court for the Central District of California, Southern Division. He's in Orange County. He's also president of the District Judges Association. And this is really for me, because I have the mic and I'm in charge here. I have argued in front of the Court of Appeal here in the L.A., downtown L.A., and they pepper you with questions about your case. I get to pepper the judge with questions. And I use the word pepper because that's a baseball term. I get to pepper the judge with questions. And just before the break, Carrie wanted to know about the DH rule.
Yes.
And by the way, folks, we're not just talking to a judge who knows the law and is an expert in the law with a great career as a judge and as a lawyer. He's an expert in baseball, and I would venture to say in basketball, well, a very great basketball player in his own right. But here's the questions. We're starting to pepper you, Judge. Here we go. Tell us about the DH rule. Why should it be banished?
Well, I could begin by citing a rule. Most baseball fields have a little sign that says no pepper play. You know that.
Right, exactly.
I'm going to overlook that rule, and I'm going to answer your question, even though you mixed your metaphor. Bottom of the ninth, cliffhanger, etc. Here we go. There should be no designated hitter rule. Like the infield fly rule, it unfairly protects a certain type of player that shouldn't be protected. The DH protects pitchers because they can't hit. The infield fly rule protects people who hit pop-ups because it just seems unfair. I think we should get away from such protectionism. Let the pitcher hit. Let him learn how to hit better if he doesn't hit well. Let the guy learn how to hit, not hit a pop-up, if that's what his skill is saying. And so I oppose the designated hitter rule. I can tell you some of my most exciting moments following baseball has come from watching pitchers hit. I can remember my most exciting moment at Dodger Stadium was watching Fernando Valenzuela get the game-winning hit in the middle of a shutout. I can remember but Kershaw hitting.
Your Honor, I got to interrupt you here, as I was interrupted many times arguing in Court of Appeal. I have to interrupt you and say, the times that the pitchers have provided excitement at the plate have been so limited versus the hitting of a designated hitter. So I respectfully disagree with, I understand you're talking about strategy and everything, but I've seen so many pitchers just fanning at the ball and creating an automatic out, and I'd rather see a home run or a triple.
Very good point, and that's why the American League agrees with you. But I would also say, when I used to watch Sandy Koufax hit, I used to think even I could hit as well as he, and he became rather the everyman of hitting. And I think that's appropriate to have in the middle of a baseball game, everyman, and I can look at Koufax and think, gosh, maybe I could do better than that. Although you do make a good point about the excitement of the DH, the price you pay for that is all the lost strategy, all the lost bunts, all the lost pinch hitting, all that. And I think that's part of baseball, but the American League has lost.
And I agree with you, and I think, I don't agree with you about the DH, but I agree with you about strategy. Just like in the law, when we present a case to a judge, you have to be aware of everything. If there were things that were just taken for granted that we didn't have to prepare for, it would make our jobs a lot easier. And I think that's the complexity of being a lawyer. Moving on really quickly, though, Judge, we need to ask you in a minute or less, tell us why Maury Wills should be elected into the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Well, I told you I became a baseball fan as a 12-year-old in 1962, and Maury Wills was the man in 62. He was the most valuable player. He led the Dodgers to 3 World Championships, since we haven't won since 88. Can you imagine 3 World Championships in a very short period of time? And Maury Wills was the offense. He was creative. At the moment the Dodgers came to L.A., it was Maury Wills that cemented the love of Angelinos to Dodger baseball. He may be in Sandy Koufax, too. Those are all important things.
Okay. Your Honor, take a break here. Let me ask you this. The fact of the matter is that we go on numbers. The Hall of Fame is predicated on numbers, not on feel-good, warm stories, which I agree with you. Maury Wills is the center of so many. What about the numbers?
The numbers. One of the important numbers is, how many rings do you have? The guy has 3 World Series rings. That is an extremely important point. That's why a guy, a shortstop like Phil Rizzuto, got in, because he got a lot of rings with the Yankees. Maury Wills has a lot of rings. More importantly, Maury Wills has a lot of other great numbers. He was a Golden Glove defensive shortstop. If you look at his average, it actually exceeds the average of other middle infielders in the Hall of Fame. And I could go through all his different numbers and crunch them, but if you actually look at them, his numbers are better than most middle infielders.
Your Honor, the best point you made right there is 3 championships. That's really telling, isn't it? I gotta move on. I wanna ask you why. Again, this is the rapid round. We're peppering you. Why is Winston Churchill your hero?
You know, saving Western civilization is a pretty good thing to point to. He didn't have the average that Maury Wills had. But
no.
I did think he saved Western civilization. And I'm also a big fan of advocacy and the proper use of the English language and using the English language in a way that makes it accessible to every man. And I think Winston Churchill and Martin Luther King were the 2 greatest orators of the English language in the last 100 years. And when I was a trial lawyer, he was an example. I certainly couldn't do as well as he, but his techniques, his use of the language, I have always found inspiring. Besides that thing about, you know, saving Western
civilization. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. We remember that one. 2 more questions really quickly. The wraparound. The last one's Carrie's. I'm going to ask it for her because I know she wants to ask you this.
Now I'm scared.
She always has this. But before I ask Carrie's question really quickly, I'm concerned about baseball. You said that football may be our new national pastime. Why is it that baseball has lost popularity, and why can't it be our national pastime anymore?
It's lost popularity because it needs more excitement in today's audacious age. And the best way to bring that excitement is to abolish the infield fly rule, to bring you full circle. But I actually think it is a slow, thoughtful game. It is popular to people of intellect who can think through the game. Those are some of the reasons it may be losing popularity.
Yeah.
I am hoping that people will recognize all its richness and the rewarding life it can give by being a fan.
I mean, I don't want to be just one of the last fans as a seam head like you. And I agree with you. For the young people, my son's 6 years old. I would love for him to have a passion for baseball. And so far, he enjoys it, but he doesn't sit through a whole game unless we're at Dodger Stadium where he can eat and drink and be merry.
Go have a catch with him, and he'll remember it forever.
We had this weekend. I got up early, had catch with Hudson. We were having a great time, and then his sister, who's 5 years old, came out crying and said that we didn't wait for her to play catch.
There you go. Let's have some women's baseball. The UCLA softball team for the women won last night.
They did, yeah.
For everyone.
And I'm proud to say that Jessica Mendoza's mother used to work with our firm.
Oh!
So for many years, Karen Mendoza was with Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn for probably 20 years. So we saw Jessica grow up and very proud of all of her accomplishments as one of the greatest softball players. Last question. This is Carrie's question.
I don't know if this is, Judge.
We only have a minute.
I don't know if what's coming out of his mouth.
She always asks.
I have no idea.
What was one of the most interesting cases that you have sat on the bench for?
Oh, wow. You actually asked a question I would ask. Okay. Yeah. We'll go with that.
Well, you know, that's easy. As a judge, all my cases are important because all the parties are important, all the positions are important. But as a lawyer, I'm going to end on a downer. I represented the city of Anaheim trying to convince Artie Moreno that the name of the team should be Anaheim Angels. And if you check the sports page, you'll see that I lost that case, and the name of the team is Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, thus creating a curse that will forever be with that team until they return Anaheim to the chests of their jerseys. So that actually was the most interesting case in many, many ways.
Wow.
But it all had to do with the curse of Artie, not you.
The curse of Artie. Well, yeah, I lost the case. Yeah. I gave up the home run and I lost the case. But
well, Judge Andrew Guilford, you have won the game today. You may have lost that case, but you stepped up to bat, stepped up to the plate in the bottom of the ninth, and I think you brought in the winning run. So we're all giving you high fives. We appreciate you coming on Gervie's Law today. It's been a real pleasure. You're my kind of guy. I wish I could sit and talk to you for hours because you have so much knowledge and very, very interesting. So we really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to the show and emailing, because who knew you were going to be more interested than Howard Wasserman.
No, that's so mean. Oh, my God.
Oh, did I really just say that? All right, well, stay in touch, Andy, and thanks for being with us
today.
Great
questions, Alan, and thanks for bearing with us, Carrie.
Thank you, yes. I've learned a lot today.
All right, we got to take a break. You're listening to Gervie's Law. After the break, we're going to talk to Tracy Tudor from Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles. You don't want to miss that right here on KBC 790.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
The world better prepare for when I'm a billionaire.
Yeah, I would have a show like...
Come on, Wayman, let me talk. What's up with that? You just want to listen to some Bruno Mars? Was it the billionaire listing?
You're funny.
$1 million listing.
$1 million.
Huh? Well, soon it's going to be $1 billion. That's where we're headed.
Probably in the next 10 years.
Didn't you have fun with the district court judge?
He was great. Man. He had so much energy, and he was actually very entertaining.
Carrie, I could see you were just like, you want to appear before that judge.
That would be great.
Yeah,
let me
you
tell
would
you.
Do well. Your case, you know, Jean Kasem, she would be dead
if he
was your judge.
No chance.
All right. Well, we're going to switch gears here really quickly because we got to talk to a really groundbreaking. I'm impressed by the fact that this damn show had so many men on it. And then finally, Tracy Tudor broke through and became like this beautiful, smart, intelligent, rich. Underline that.
Understatement.
Real estate agent on Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles. She's a real estate agent for Douglas Elliman. And I got to ask you, Tracy, you have accomplished so much in your career. Now you're like this reality star and you're selling so much real estate. Growing up in Hidden Hills, and by the way, my wife grew up with you in Hidden Hills and went to school with
oh,
you.
No
but
way.
Yeah, yeah, but that's besides the point. She loved horses. She rode. She went to school riding horses. And I know you were into horses because your two daughters, I guess, are doing the equestrian thing. But did you ever think, even with a father who was so involved in construction and contracting, did you ever think you would be doing what you're doing with so many fans watching you do your work?
Well, truly, I kind of did when I was young. I told my dad when I was like 15 years old and I joined a singing group called Everything Nice that I wasn't going to college and I was going to be a huge pop star. And if he didn't support me, that I was not going to thank him when I got my first Grammy. So on some level, I think I was going to end up on TV. But truly, I studied theater in college and came out of USC undergrad and with a degree in theater. And 2 years later, I woke up and said, I don't want to do this. I'm not making money doing this. And I want to be financially independent, and sort of landed a gig in real estate. And now 19 years later, it's come full circle. And I'm 43 years old with two kids and I'm back on television. So
that's amazing. You know, it's funny because my wife kind of did the opposite. She went to film school at USC and then became a real estate agent. And then she gave up all of it to be a mother. So you're doing all of it, all three things that she's done at one point in her life.
Yeah, it's crazy.
How do you do it?
I don't know how I'm doing it, to be honest with you, but it's called very good iCal scheduling.
Yeah. I'm the opposite of both you, Nancy and Tracy. My dad always said, you should try radio. You should try radio. That was his thing, American Top 40. He's like, you know, you should do voiceovers. And I thought he was crazy. I looked at him, I said, but nobody can see you. You know, I'm like, and now here I am. I'm 22 years in radio, but I did the opposite. I actually did what, you know, my dad wanted me to do. And not necessarily. He always said, you can do anything you want. Just get your education. You can do anything you want. You'll be great. But how long did it take you, Tracy, to start selling?
I've been doing it for 19 years, but as far as selling, getting into the business goes, I was in my early 20s, and I came into a small company called Dalton Brown & Long at the time, which was on the corner of Sunset and Doheny, where the famous Soho House is now. And I went in, sat down with the manager and said, look, I'm brand new to this, but I grew up here. I knew a lot of fancy people. And so, you know, this is what I'm going to do. And I need to make $90,000 a year to survive. And the manager started laughing and looked at me and was like, you know, are you aware what most agents make in their first 2 years in real estate on average? I said, no. And he said, $30,000 a year. And I said, well, wow, that's just not going to work for me. And he was like, you're hired. So, you know, cut to what did I make in my first 2 years in real estate? $30,000 a year.
And how long did it take before you actually started selling these multi-million dollar homes?
I would say I had my first taste of real success probably in my third year of real estate when I joined a team and I started representing properties and buyers that, you know, where I had a mentor for guiding me and you know, someone that's been in the business much longer than me, and his name was Russ Felice. And I think joining a team was the best thing I ever did. And I was exposed to a lot more sophisticated clients. And, you know, I think no matter who you know and what you know, people with money aren't going to trust you just because you're a friend of the family. You have to have experience. And so I think aligning myself with the right people was the best thing I ever did. And that was really the first taste of success I had. And I was, 26 or 27 years old at the time. And I quickly realized that I was going to make a lot more money than I had ever dreamed of in a business that I never really sought out to be in.
You know, it's interesting because people see you on the show and they think that, oh, you know, she's amazing. She's a psychologist. She takes care of all her clients and she's running to crises and solving problems and dealing with so many people. But they don't really realize that it's not only you. And you make a point when you talk about a team, you joined a team and then you started to take off. We had Laura Wasser on the show not too long ago, who's a divorce attorney, and you may know her or may know someone at her firm.
Yes, I know her very well.
Yeah.
But she said, you know, she sat in with Carrie and I here in studio and said, it takes a village. People think that I can do my gig on my own, but it takes a village. Isn't that true of you too, Tracy?
100%. I mean, in our business, there's so many facets to representing high-end property in Los Angeles. And, you know, I went in on a major pitch today and I had a support system of four people with me. Now, granted, it was a much bigger pitch than I'm used to going out on, but, you know, you got to put the right people in place that can support your vision for what it is that you're going out for. And when you have those people in place and you trust them and you let them drive their ship, then, you know, the stars align and that's when you start having success. You can never do it on your own.
And it's interesting when you say you make the pitch and it was a big one, but you're used to some big pitches. And I read somewhere that this guy, you know, in the white garb, Issam Galadi, the director of the Royal Atlanta.
Issam Galadari.
Yeah, okay, however you say that.
It's like John Travolta.
I'm impressed. So Tracy did her homework. Yes. She knows how to pronounce his name. And he said to you in the pitch for the Royal Atlantis residence in Dubai, he said, convince me why you're up to the challenge. Is that true? Did the guy really say that to you?
1,000%. Yes. And when you're pitching for, you know, gigantic opportunities like the Royal Atlantis in Dubai, you're pitching an international property that you're going to be an ambassador for in the U.S. So I had to do a lot of studying to get in the room to even be able to have him have enough faith in me to even have a conversation. But second to that, when you're talking to someone of that caliber, you better know what you're talking about. And
right.
I knew in that moment when he said to me, why are you here and what are you really standing behind? And I said, I don't represent a property that I don't get behind, particularly at this level. If I don't believe in it and I don't think the taste level, the choices, the brand and the product that I'm, you know, in front of you to pitch for, if I don't believe in it, then I shouldn't even be sitting here.
I'm surprised.
Because these projects take years. So if you're committing to something like that and you're committing a lot of money, time and effort to it, you better know it, be behind it and understand it.
And was that all you had to say? And he was like, okay, let's do this.
But Carrie, I'm surprised.
Are you joking?
I want to know how did you convince this guy?
Wait a second, Tracy, you know you said $30,000 just ain't going to cut it for me.
$30 million. No,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
No, I mean that's almost $1 billion sellout, and to be even a part of a brand like the Royal Atlantis was a huge opportunity to me. It's my first expansion into the international waters of real estate, and I wanted it bad.
Yeah.
So no, it did not stop there. Days after that, I was put in a situation in their sales gallery where I had to pitch to a group of about 40 local brokers, and he came in and watched me do showings, pitch the finish gallery, talk about the sales model, talk about what it is that we're doing, price points, and I did it on the fly. And it was only after he saw me in a room with actual brokers pitching his product that he gave me the job.
Well, congratulations. It's huge. I mean,
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm sure that Josh Altman or Josh Flagg weren't in the room, because I'm sure they would have tried to steal the business from you.
Oh, God love them. You know what? Dog eat dog world.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the way you have to accept the business. It's not like you're going to be best friends, but at the same time, you got to work together. Are some of the relationships on the show kind of fabricated, or are they real?
Absolutely
she's
not.
She's not going to answer that question,
Alex. No, she's not.
Oh, yeah, it's all fake, guys. You know, we did this. We just, it's a script. We're real good actors.
I'm going to tell you something right now. I'm super authentic on the show, and every relationship I have, the relationship I have with Josh Altman is 100% authentic. Flagg, the Bond Street Boys, same thing. Josh Flagg and Josh Altman have always had a little bit of a competitive nature. They've definitely been through the ringer together, and they've had their fair share of fights, but we're all big boys, and you know, we grow up a little bit, and every year that goes by, you get a little bit more mature. But they've also, both of them have, you know, Altman is on his second baby. He's been married in the last 5 years. He has his first daughter and now a son about to be born. Josh Flagg is married to Bobby now. I mean, they're starting to grow up. And
right.
I think, you know, that speaks to a little bit of, you know, I think the maturity that we see on the show in the last season a little bit, and, you know, hopefully in the coming.
You know, that happens in a lot of different professions. As lawyers, I have absolutely had knock down, drag out fights with other lawyers. And then, you know, we end up having a drink together 2 months later or whatever. It's just, it's part of what you do, what other people do. And, you know, you can see the authenticity of the show. And when, as a lawyer, I have evidence, because I saw the Rose McGowan episode. Your tears were real. Your heart was real. You were really thinking of her. So it wasn't just a TV put on, unless you can tell me you're an incredible actress.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a damn good actress.
But that has nothing to do with it.
I'm kidding. No, I got to be totally honest with you. Like that, it was the first time that they ever did an on-the-fly interview where, you know, they kind of brought me downstairs sort of in the thick of things and shot an interview with me on the fly. And I think that was one of the greatest episodes of last season, because I think it really truly captured a very unproduced moment on the show where we weren't going back and talking about a particular piece of property or something that had happened maybe a week before.
Right.
We were talking about it in the moment. And it was a really difficult call that I had to have with Rose. And I was emotional and I gave a shit, and I do about all of my clients. And in that case, you're absolutely right. It was 100% authentic.
And you must have really felt great about the results, because obviously it worked out the way you had anticipated it could work out.
Listen, at the end of the day, I'm glad that we were able to do what we could for her. I wish she didn't have to do it at all, but, you know, She started a revolution, and things are starting to change, particularly in the entertainment field in Los Angeles and everywhere. And she was a big part of that. So, yeah, if I had my hand in even 1% of what she was able to do, that's something I'm very proud of.
Right. And you should be. And you know, we've dealt with that on our show on many occasions, had Gloria Allred on, talked about some of the victims. And it's an important issue. And for those of you who didn't see the episode, they can still see it through Bravo. It's Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles. And by the way, she had to sell all of her, and Carrie's looking at me because she doesn't know this, but she had to sell a lot of stuff to make some money.
Yeah.
A lot of Hollywood memorabilia that she
had. She sold a lot. She sold everything in her house, but the two suitcases she took with her, also all 100% true. So that entire experience kind of really shaped for me how I wanted to handle the rest of the season. It was the first day of shooting when we picked up the selling of all of her pieces and the estate sale. And it was a major part of you know, going, you know what, I think we're doing something really different this season, and I'm proud of it. And I hope that we continue to obviously showcase really great real estate and really great stories, which is, I think, why people tune into the show, but also, you know, really authentic situations that are not always about glitz and glamour. And they don't always sell. They don't always close.
We want to talk about that after break. We have to take a quick break. We're talking to Tracy Tudor, star of Bravo's Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles, real estate agent for Douglas Elliman in Beverly Hills. Is it Beverly Hills or Bel Air?
Beverly Hills.
I know, but I just wanted you to say, I sell Bel Air too. All right, we'll be right back after this break.
Need a new perspective on law and life? Call Alan Gervey and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Tell me.
Well, we don't have to wait for a lot of words to get to the bottom line, how to be a millionaire. Way to go, Wayman. Way to get that. You hit that one out of the ballpark. We're talking to Tracy Tudor, the star of Bravo's Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles, on Thursday nights at 9 Eastern, 6 in L.A. And she has been very public recently about certain things that have gone on in personal life. We talked before the break about how authentic she is on the show, as are her colleagues, the other brokers. And Tracy, you have been really upfront about things in your personal life, your divorce, selling your house. Why is it that you have been able to come out and just kind of let things be in the public without hiding anything?
Because I believe in managing the message. I sell real estate, obviously, and I tell my clients all the time, you know, when you represent someone that's high profile or a high profile property, it's best to get out in front of the message. We live in a world that's completely media obsessed, and most everything becomes public, whether you like it or not. So the best thing I could do for myself in terms of living a public life, because I'm now on a TV show, is to get out in front of it and at least present the message that I want to present and control it that way. So it's always going to come from me. And most of the things that you will see that come out in the media at all are going to be from me, at least to date. Crossing my fingers that continues that way.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it will. And it's worked out for you from what we can see in the media. Obviously, the most important thing are your two daughters, Juliet and Scarlett. And that's something that you felt important, as well as your ex-husband, about protecting them, not putting them on the show or exploiting them. Is that something that was really important to both of you? And is that why the whole divorce situation wasn't as complex and infuriating as it could be?
No. I mean, I think regarding my two children, Jason and I both agreed that, you know, for the time being, it was in the best interest of our privacy and our relationship and our kids to not put them out there in the media and on the show. And whether or not it continues down that road is entirely up to Jason and I. But for now, you know, and certainly for last season, it was the choice that we made as a family.
I want to know if there's ever been a situation, and of course you don't need to say the name or who it is, where you've just had some crazy like crazy person that you were trying to. Yeah, but I want to know the craziest.
She hates all her clients.
I know,
like,
but
all,
not necessarily on the show. Not necessarily on the show, but something you could tell us. Because I love stories like this, the behind the scenes that didn't make the camera, somebody really super nutty.
And don't worry, I'm a lawyer. I'll protect against any lawsuits.
We don't have to say it.
I mean, I really don't have anybody that is that over the top. I mean, certainly I think my clients on the show have great personality and big personalities.
Yeah, for sure.
Some not as much. I've always found that to be a lot more interesting. And I think that's why, you know, fans have resonated with me on the show in a different way, because a lot of my stuff is relationship based, as you mentioned earlier. It's not necessarily about selling the biggest house, but managing personalities and sort of understanding how to connect with those people. I have had my fair share of crazy. There's no doubt about it.
I want to hear one. I do. And listen, I'll tell you, I had a great, this is coming from another big time realtor. And one of the clients he was going around with, it was a very, very famous man and his wife, and he was showing homes. And the wife fell in love with this house, and it was very expensive. He could have purchased it, but he didn't want to go that high. She literally fell down to the ground and had a screaming, like, tantrum on the ground. The wife. I mean,
stop it.
Yes. He said it was the worst thing he's ever experienced. Like, literally sat down.
The worst? Refusing. Or like the best?
What was the best? Like, it was so embarrassing.
I would have
he didn't know what to do. And it was just, I mean, the husband was embarrassed and just like this complete, like, a child's tantrum on the floor.
No, yeah. Yeah. I haven't experienced anything that nutty. You know, I've sat across my fair share of negotiations and you know, had to step out of the room for a minute and recalibrate my ability to maintain my temper.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have definitely made a few apologies in my day to clients and, you know, vice versa. And I think when you're talking about the biggest asset that you have, and generally when people are selling real estate, that is their biggest asset. And so people get nuts.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
But, you know, it usually happens after a little bit of time together, because if you watch the show, you see the relationships that start and everyone's best buddies and friends. And then when you present them with an offer and it's $2 million less than what they wanted, all of a sudden there's some tension. How do you deal with that? Because we see it over and over, whether it's talking about multi-million dollar homes or smaller homes, where the client all of a sudden is like, hey, you said you were going to get me more money.
Where's my money?
Well, you know, I think in negotiations, you know, everybody's always emotional. They say they're not, but they are. And even listing my own house, you know, I have an idea of value of what I think that is. When the actual offer comes in, I'm going to have to put my business hat on and evaluate every aspect of the deal and decide, you know, how I want to respond. And I always tell my sellers, when I am dealing with the sellers, that their first counter offer is generally the most important. And I tell my buyers, you know, if you want to start here, just know that you better be prepared to move off that number.
Yeah.
There's no point in presenting it at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the best deals and the best negotiations usually end with both the seller and the buyer feeling like they gave up more than they wanted to.
Yep, that's right. And I think that's great advice for people to listen to. I got to tell you, though, Tracy, try and be easy on your agent when you sell your own house. Don't take it out on her if the price isn't what you think it should be.
Are you the agent?
My poor business partner, God bless her. It was leading up to the prep work for the sale and getting the house perfect, because I'm a perfectionist, was probably a very rough couple of weeks. So I'm sorry, Gina.
You know, I got to say, I loved what you said when someone asked you who you hoped would buy the home, and you said, whoever will write the check.
Yeah.
And candidly, and I don't care what they do to it after I'm gone. I will probably have an emotional moment and you know, look back at the memories that I've had here and all of that. But then once I'm out the door and I hand them over the keys, they could tear it down for all
there,
I care.
There
as
you
long
go.
As I have a check in hand that clears,
that's right.
You know, what I'm all about.
And that's what people should take away from this. You know, that's it's not really all about emotion. Let's just do what you're set out to do. The show is called Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles. She is Tracy Tudor, real estate agent for Douglas Elliman. The show airs Thursday night. Now, how many shows do you have left in the season?
Well, this season has we've actually already had the finale, so they're still airing the show,
right.
and we are in the process of starting a new season, so that's very exciting.
Because I know it's still airing, and then you'll have an opportunity next season, and you'll be you're contracted on again.
I cannot confirm or deny.
What a perfect legal answer for a legal show. Tracy Tudor, thanks so much for being with us today on Gervie's Law.
It was a pleasure. Thank you,
good
guys.
Luck.
Thank
with,
you.
Good luck with all your projects.
Bye.
Okay, bye. Well, she's as honest as they come. There you go. An honest real estate agent.
Well,
just like an honest lawyer.
Oh,
I'm just going to leave that one alone. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next week right here on Gervie's Law.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.